This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, because you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Harvesting Nature's Wild Fish and Game Podcast. You got your host here, Justin Townsend, and today we have a very special episode. We've got another guest with us, and this is also our first episode from sunny Colorado. So I made the big leap from the Florida Keys up to Colorado now, and so we're working on mountain time, which is very interesting for the scheduling piece, but excited nonetheless for the fall season and the things to come. So with that, I want to go through a bit of our news. So big news is the move for me. Right before we moved, literally the week before, I was up in Missoula, Montana at the BHA Rendezvous. So happy to announce that Adam Steele and I took third place in the wild food competition. We would have loved first place, but it was a pretty awesome competition. We made some jerk alligator with a mango cream sauce, and also a bunch of wild foraged greens, and what else did we do? Oh, fried green tomatoes with the crust. We used some dried plantain, which we crumbled up to make a nice little crust on the tomatoes. We were challenged and tasked to create a meal that represented our state, which would have been Florida at the time, which I think we did pretty successfully. So in the judging, we had Hank Shaw was there, as well as Clay Newcomb, and Rachel from Elevated Wild was there, and a couple other folks as well. Really excited to have them judging us, and they gave us some great feedback both before and after the show. So it was good to see that happen. The winners ended up taking it, I believe they were from Minnesota, and made a cool duck and wild rice dish with some foraged mushrooms, and they did a lot of entertaining and telling stories, and I think that got the competitive edge on us. But, Colin, what information or new stuff you got for us going on?
Hey, everybody, it's Colin. I think it's been a couple episodes since I've been on. But I got two bits of info, or updates, I guess you could call them. I put in for my Oregon tags. I ended up getting a controlled hunt deer tag, which is, pretty much a guarantee. And then I ended up striking out again on elk tags, tried to game the system. I wouldn't call it gaming. I tried to strategize, and then one of the results from this year's tag application season, I think they had like a 15% increase in tag applications across Oregon. So the unit that I was trying to go after had 7,000 more tags applied for than last year. And that kind of shoved me out, kind of ruined my strategy that I was going for. But I still got a general elk tag, so I'll be looking forward to those 4 days in November coming up. And then I also reached out to a local farm here for the possibility of hunting nutria on there. I know I've seen them around there. I've been duck hunting on there, and they said they were open to it. So myself and a guy I know from work, we're probably just going to go and walk around some of the cowless pastures they have there and look for nutria. I just got 2 furs back from some that we got in November, and they came out awesome. So I'm eager to get some more and maybe make a hat or some gloves out of them or something.
I would say the real question is, are you making a nutria hat?
Oh, well, yeah, that's without question. Nutria hat is definitely in the cards. And then also, you know, see what I can make with them. Slow cooker, roast them. Supposedly it's not that bad. I'll probably have to season it a little bit and get used to it. But, you know, I want to make sure I'm using all the animal that I can, not just letting it go to waste. But, yeah, it'll be cool kind of off-season opportunity to go.
It's always interesting when you lead off with it's supposed to be not that bad.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to sugarcoat it a little bit. But, no, it's a good opportunity, I think, for some off-season hunting and taking care of some invasive species. So looking forward to that.
Nice. Oh, another bit of news that I forgot to mention. So we've just been out here a couple weeks, but we did break off from the big city of Denver here and headed up to Breckenridge this last weekend and fished a couple of the alpine lakes up there. Caught a good mess of trout. Made trout meuniere last night, which was pretty good. So if you don't know what that is, it's like floured and pan-fried whole trout that you basically then drizzle a clarified butter and lemon and parsley sauce on top of, and just kind of eat it off the bone. Man, it was phenomenal. Even Zoe, my daughter, who's the big critic of the house, mowed through, with a little help, mowed through her trout easier than expected, which was good. So that's always exciting when that happens. I think updates from others. Corey's dealing with a rainstorm right now. Otherwise, he would have been joining us. Ben is off traveling the world today somewhere in the U.S. He'll be back next week, so hopefully we can get him back on for a crew chat, catch up with him. Ryan and Emily are down at Texas. Actually paid a visit to Dai Due Supper Club, if you recollect back a couple episodes ago. We had Jesse Griffiths on the show, and they were actually down that way and stopped into the restaurant to say hello and have a meal. So I got pictures of the meal. It looked incredible, and pictures of the menu, which also looked awesome as well. So big shout out to Jesse and his...
What did they have to eat?
That's a good question, Colin. Thanks for putting me on the spot.
I guess you'll just have to go to their page and find out for yourself.
Yeah, yeah. No, I have the pictures on my phone. It's just in correlating the recipe, and they didn't send text as to what each dish was.
All right.
But it all looked good from the pictures, so I'm excited next time I'm down in Austin to visit. So also want to give a shout out to our Adventures for Food podcast. If you roll back probably three or four episodes, you will find an Adventures for Food. So this is your opportunity as the guest and listener to hop onto the podcast and tell your story. So it's not hosted. It's only you on there recording a favorite wild fish or wild game hunting story of your choice. Just kind of telling the adventure, what it was like for you, much like a campfire story or sitting at the kitchen table having a beer with friends. It's a really cool podcast. Check that out. And then always our Facebook community page group where you can interact with us more on a day-to-day basis. And then if you're digging what we're doing, then you can always buy us a cup of coffee. There's a link down in the show notes to buy us a cup of coffee there. $3 goes a long way, helps fuel those long nights of podcast editing, recipe writing, and adventure planning. But speaking of Austin, our guest today is a resident of Austin. And I would like to introduce him. He is the co-founder and CEO at Force of Nature, a regeneratively sourced meat company He's also a land steward at the Rome Ranch, regeneratively managing his own bison. And you can often find him on a trail, on the ocean, on a mountain, or in a field, always making time to appreciate nature and explore his surroundings. Welcome to the Wild Fish and Game Podcast, Robbie Sansom.
Hey guys, I happy to be here. Thanks for the warm welcome. I gotta say that was a quite a tasty question, tasty sandwich y'all made with that amazing sounding gator dish, and then highly questionable nutria followed by another trout meunier or whatever. I can't even say it. It sounded fantastic, but I'm gonna have to follow back up to hear about how that nutria tastes.
Yeah, longtime listeners will know that I generally don't come up with the greatest, most delicious sounding stuff. It's just kind of like off the wall, whatever.
I think Justin said it best when you qualified it with probably not going to be that great, but I'm going to eat it anyway. I can definitely respect the intention there, though, to honor the animal and you know, make use of every aspect of it that you can. So, joking aside, I absolutely respect that and appreciate you saying that.
Oh no. Thanks, I appreciate that. At the very least, it'll make a good Adventures for Food episode, I think. So stay tuned.
We got to start thinking of a quick, a crafty title for that episode.
Yeah, I'll get on that.
I mean, even if it doesn't taste good, just have Justin make up some fancy name for it, and I'm sure that spin will bring it home.
Yeah, Nutria Meunier.
Yeah, something with a lot of alliteration or like a French name to it. Yeah, make it sound way better than it actually is.
So, Robbie, will you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, what you are involved in the outdoor world as well?
Yeah, sure. I think you guys already got the part about being from Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. I was actually born and raised here, so it's exceedingly rare in these parts to be a native. But love being in Central Texas. Grew up running around the hill country, as they call it in this area, and then heading down to the coast and spending a lot of time inshore fishing in the flats, as we would call it, and a little bit of time offshore, and then as much as I can traveling around and getting in mountains and playing, whether that be wintertime or springtime, summertime. So, just like you read in that kind of brief bio, unfortunately, professionally, I got to spend a lot of time in front of a computer, but, I try to balance that out with spending as much time out of doors as possible doing, what I call adventuring, whatever that may be. Right.
It's good. Nice. I always find it's like a common theme for people who really, really love the outdoors and like to be in it. And, in our position where, your 9-to-5 or your normal job kind of keeps you inside, it's always the common answer of how often do you spend in the outdoors? It's usually like as much time as I can, but it's usually not enough.
Totally.
So, for you, how did you get your start in the farming and culinary world?
Yeah, I kind of did the traditional schooling route. Went to undergrad and grad school, got a master's degree, and all those sorts of things, and did big consulting with big firms and all that. But kind of as we just started off the conversation with, I grew up hunting and fishing, running around Texas. Mm-hmm. I can remember as a kid setting an alarm in the middle of the night when there's a full moon, grabbing my fishing pole and running down trying to throw topwaters and catch bass, same thing depending on the seasons, whether it's a rifle or a rod, running around and doing those things, and then gaining an appreciation for outdoors and conservation and recognizing that these resources are, they're finite and they need to be managed and stewarded and cared for, or we'll lose them. Serendipity, really, reconnected with a couple of friends of mine, Katie Forrest, Taylor Collins, who had, founded a company called Epic Provisions. And
yeah, I know of Epic.
Yeah. And so, you know, I had been doing business consulting and then went in the startup world and had a really successful first foray into running startup, fast growth, mission-based businesses. And, you know, we were all doing triathlons and riding bikes and stuff like that. And they said, hey, we just launched this bar a few months ago. It's going bananas. We could really use some help kind of scaling this business, professionalizing it. We got some big goals. And so I joined the founding team there, and the three of us ran that company and grew it. And we're very fortunate that it ended up being and still is extremely influential in the meat-based agriculture space, right? But that was the first time really in not just my career, but in my life where my passions collided with, and you know, outside of work, right? My personal passions collided with my job and my professional passions. I love running businesses. I love, it's just like the most fascinating puzzle imaginable, right? And you get to deal with people and hopefully improve their lives in the process, right? So, but yeah, when you're trying to figure out how to make healthy meat that honors values that consumers of today, you know, which are generally speaking welfare for animals and, you know, thoughtfulness around the communities that are producing food and positive, you know, impacts on ecosystems and natural habitat. You know, you can't help but go deeply quickly down a rabbit hole of agriculture and what challenges does our current agriculture system promote, and what solutions are there for those. And fortunately, you know, contrary to the popular narrative, animals aren't evil, and they were put here for a reason, and they perform key ecosystem services. And there's a way to celebrate that in our agriculture systems. And, you know, we're trying to champion that message and create awareness that, you know, with some subtle shifts, we can improve the food that we eat. We can improve the environment that, that we enjoy and benefit from all the things that it gives to us symbiotically, and improve the livelihoods of people in rural areas producing our food, and get healthier, cleaner food and water as part of the process. And we don't have to do it by paying a bunch of engineers and PhDs to make intellectual property and channel money to more billionaires. So it's pretty cool.
It's overall just kind of taking a better, more steady, locally driven hand in agriculture and in the way we eat.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly trying to take a step back from the you know, there's extremes. Pendulums always swing, right? Mm-hmm. And we're way out on the extreme of a pendulum right now with our incredibly centralized, industrialized, commoditized agriculture system. It's so brittle, in fact, that not all, you know, recently we saw it with, you know, the cyber attacks, and a year ago we saw it with COVID, where, you know, it doesn't take much to disrupt the entire supply chain of meat across the country. And even last year it was more profound, where, you know, there was excess supply and excess demand of animal protein simultaneously, and farmers were having to euthanize animals because they couldn't get them into processing because a couple of plants were down, right? That's madness to us probably in this conversation and listening. Mm-hmm. Well, because we know what to do and how to handle that, right? But our system has become so brittle and fragile in the name of hyper-efficiency that it's lost the flexibility to truly be stable. And not only is the cost of that a lack of access for the average consumer, but that's come on the backs of 5,000 to 10,000 family-owned farms a year that lose their generational wealth and lose their ability to produce. And we have globally a situation where farmer suicide is higher than the rate of suicide for veterans returning from war. I mean, it's a plight. It's a tragedy what's happening. And these are the people that we want producing our food. Don't you want your neighbors producing your food? Families that have dedicated their entire history and lineage to feeding, proudly feeding us, you know, versus it being just some Fortune 500 company or some an industry backed by a bunch of investors. No, I want people involved in my food supply, and I want them happy, and I want them healthy, and I want them part of thriving communities, you know.
So I'll I'll say this. So a lot of our listeners at this point in the conversation may be scratching their head going, hey, wait, this is a wild fishing game podcast. It's like you guys are talking about agriculture pretty heavily at this point. And I want to preface this thing and say that, you know, we wanted to talk with Robbie about Force of Nature Meats and about regenerative agriculture, you know, because we think it really goes hand in hand with hunting and fishing, like harvesting your own protein and really just wrapping your head around it and understanding where your food comes from and plugging back into the food system and understanding that. So that's kind of the overarching point of this conversation to bring it in. And I think several episodes ago, someone had asked me my thoughts on agriculture, and you know, longtime listeners know, like, I grew up in an agriculture family, and I understand the value of it. And just as much as I value hunting, I value the farmers and ranchers too, as well. I mean, they play a vital part in our economy, in our food supply, in everything. And I think that those conversations should be had as well. You know, I love getting my protein from the wild. I like foraging as much as I can and as much as I've learned. But, you know, you still get vegetables from somewhere. You still, in a pinch, need to find food supplies to complement whatever other protein you may have. So there's a definite importance in that. That's one of the main reasons we wanted to have Robbie on this evening.
Well, Jess, I think that's a great point, and I appreciate that context for folks listening in. And you know, I think the scale of agriculture, it just blows right over people's heads. I don't think they understand. Mm-hmm. Most of the average person understands how much land. You fly on a plane, you see it, but you probably think that that's just unique. It's specific to that flight line, right? You look down, you see all the squares on the ground. But you know, the truth is, the United States is only a couple billion acres, and about half of that is currently being farmed. Right, that's a lot of land. Mm-hmm. When we're talking to in a community here, of folks that care about wildlife, right? Well, that wildlife needs a place to be, and needs a place, and it needs a certain setup within that system to be able to thrive and be healthy, and to maintain its numbers for future generations. Ideally, even grow those numbers. And if we can find a path where we can practice agriculture and feed our communities in a way that allows for wildlife and lands to exist and support our native animal communities as well, that's the best of both worlds, right? Because then we get to have our cake and eat it too. The inverse of that is, you know, we have agriculture systems that continue to grow and take up wild ecosystems, and put monocultures in their place. And that's, you know, millions or thousands of square miles of tilled up land with one species, and that's it, right? And you know, there's a way to do that better for that farmer, and a way to do that better for those ecosystems and that wildlife, to make sure we can have more and of both and better outcomes for both. And that includes folks that want to fish, right? You know, putting herbicide, pesticide, fungicide, fertilizer, all that stuff. You know, the more of it we spray, the more it runs through and creates dead zones and algae blooms and all sorts of stuff. And again, we're doing it for a reason. We're trying to feed people. But if there's a better way without doing it that benefits everybody, we should be exploring it. And that's the kind of path and awareness we're trying to create and travel down.
And that's sort of, correct me if I'm wrong, but looking at regenerative agriculture, that's sort of the path and the model that builds in, correct?
Yeah, totally. I mean, that one of the in its simplest form, regenerative agriculture is an effort to replace inputs with management, right? So, you know, I just listed off some chemical inputs, right? And then there's some mechanical disturbance that you can maybe do in the form of heavy tillage and frequent tillage as well, for a variety of reasons. And then we're replacing that with management, where, you know, we're trying to figure out, hey, there's a few billion years of blueprints here and working with nature. Can we manage our land a little bit differently and figure out how we can work with it instead of against it? And if in doing so, do we get some more positive, more positive outcomes, right? And that tends to be realized and again, net positive outcomes, you know, environmentally speaking, on lands that are managed in accordance with regenerative principles. But also favorable financial outcomes for those farmers and those communities, right? And And then, of course, that passes through to consumers in the form of, you know, healthier, more abundant food. In its simplest forms, there's a lot more nuance to it than that, but that's really what it boils down to is, hey, can we replace a system that sort of is engaged a little bit in a chemical and mechanical warfare with nature and replace it with one that wants to work symbiotically with it and leave everybody better for it.
And so this was kind of the path that you chose in the foundation of Force of Nature.
Well, through that journey with Epic, like I had mentioned a moment ago, we had, you know, that was sort of what took us down the rabbit hole, right? We were saying, hey, we want to create healthy, convenient meat that folks can take with them on whatever their adventure may be, whether it's a long bike ride or a hike or a hunting trip or out on a boat somewhere, you know, having a little 1.5 ounce bar of bison or venison or some beef with you is nice to not have to have a cooler and a refrigerator and a grill and a fire or whatever. You know, we wanted to source healthy meat. So where's healthy that come from? It comes from healthy animals. Where do healthy animals come from? Well, they come from healthy land where they're allowed to exhibit their natural behaviors that they evolved, to exhibit. And healthy land with healthy animals comes from healthy soil. And it turns out in our current agriculture system, we're doing a lot of stuff that's degrading our soil over time. It has short-term gains and, you know, kind of helps prop up and actually perpetuate itself. But long-term, you know, we're seeing the need for more amendments and more and heavier applications and new chemicals and new innovations to continue to keep up with our, you know, historical yield levels as we continue to degrade a resource that is finite. And that there's a tragic end if we continue to race to the bottom in that regard. But there's a simple solution that actually, you know, turns that ship around, and we can start to improve that soil base and improve that land base and improve again the environment as well as the food coming out of it.
It's just it amazes me too when you talk about the additive and the inputs and the various things going into the soil. It's just like that comes at a cost too, you know, whether it through labor or whether it through dollar for products or chemicals or whatever additives you're putting in. And it's just, I don't know that a lot of people realize that, you know, it's the farmer that bears the burden of that, because the consumer oftentimes doesn't want the price to change. So then costs are cut in certain places where it's not always the ideal thing, and you go back to happy farmers and happy lifestyles.
Yeah, and then we're sort of trained, you know, like with many things, the what's real may not be how we're perceiving it, right? You know, people... Mm-hmm. You know, meat is a good example. You know, if you ask somebody to pay an extra, you know, couple dollars a pound for some meat, that's, it seems expensive, right? But the most premium meat that, you know, our ground, beef, for example, I think it's like 50 cents an ounce. A Hershey's bar is 99.5 cents an ounce. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever complains about Hershey's being expensive, but our meat is seen as real expensive because it's premium, right? And the difference is that you can survive on 3 or 4 ounces of our meat. It'll still give you 20 or 30 grams of protein and all the micro and macronutrients that you need. And, you know,
such a great example,
right? You think of all these, you think of the tragedy of all these folks in food deserts or in low income communities where they're eating meals in convenience stores, right? And they're getting, you know, some crappy processed chips or crappy extra large soda and some other garbage that's made to taste really good so you get addicted to it, but offer you nothing except for maybe cancer on the side. You know, they're doing that because of what's available and what they can afford. But the truth is, a quarter pound of ground meat will give you so much more than that at a lower cost. We just don't see it that way. We're just not trained to see it that way by, you know, the way people look at and think about and talk about food and pricing.
Being a native of Hershey, Pennsylvania, I do have to agree with you on the premium price of chocolate. Hershey's is not the greatest chocolate, but you get what you pay for.
And, well,
you have to.
And I think that's an even better example, right? Because nobody bats something. Yeah. You start getting into designer chocolate, and just you throw the book out on what's expensive, right?
Right.
And the same thing can be said for wine and olive oil and vinegar, and, you know, don't even think about looking at the price per pound for nuts, Or those awesome mushrooms that you're probably foraging, Justin, getting out of the wild, you know, you dry those things out and it's just the add a zero to whatever the average person thinks that's going to cost in bulk. So, our perception of price and what's expensive or not expensive relative to what we truly need in our body, what nourishes our bodies and what we need to survive on is really kind of a whole screwed up story in and of itself.
And I think what you were saying about like, if you have to add a couple dollars per pound for a higher quality meat, then people are going to look at that as, maybe it's a deterrent for some people. But in the end, then they're going to go to the cheaper meat, which just ends up fueling the big farm companies anyway. And it's just kind of like this endless cycle. And it's, I don't know what the solution is. I don't know if you have a solution for it. But that's just something I picked up on when you were talking about it there.
Yeah, maybe I should talk a little bit in more detail about what regenerative agriculture is and maybe compare a couple of systems, if that's all right.
Yeah, I like it.
Go for it.
There's five principles that you will hear talked about most often in regenerative agriculture, right? And the first one is and again, this is all context based. These aren't rules, hard lines in the sand. These are practices where, you know, it's trying to coach in a direction and guide an outcome, right? So the first principle is limit chemical and mechanical disturbance. You know, I talked about the spraying of chemicals. We do all those things for a lot of reasons, but there are alternatives that can be just as, if not more effective, for, you know, driving those same desirable outcomes that farmers spray for by not spraying, right? Mechanical disturbance, as I mentioned, would be, you know, heavy tillage, right? And you know, there's estimates that a third of the legacy carbon load in the atmosphere is the direct result of tilling over the last few generations on a global scale. And wherever you are on like the atmospheric carbon, climate, whatever conversation, at the end of the day, we need is carbon in our soils because we're all carbon-based life and that's where it belongs. That's what creates life coming from the soil. We need this carbon that's supposed to be in our soil back in our soil, not in the atmosphere. And the way that you do that is with plants on the ground. So that second principle is armor the soil. Leave the ground covered. With the litter and thatch and mulch that natural organic matter would put on the land, right? That protects it from baking in the sun, right? You guys, we spend enough time in the outdoors community outside, you know, when it's hot, it's real damn hot. And black soil can get above 140 degrees, if not quite a bit above it. And if you think about, you know, Chef Justin over here with his food thermometers, what temperature is meat safe to eat? At what temperature are you killing pathogens and bacteria, right? Not much lower than that. So you're nuking the microbiome, the rhizosphere in your soil, the thing that gives all life, we destroy by letting it bake in the sun. And inversely, the same thing can happen in the winter, but you put a layer of ground cover on that and it retains moisture. It stays cooler in the summer. It stays warmer in the winter and it creates food, for microbiological life. So, you know, armoring the soil is really important as a second principle. The third principle is green growing plants year round, or some would say living roots. That's key. I kind of touched on that a moment ago, but green leaves on grasses and plants and all of it, right? That allows photosynthesis to occur. And what photosynthesis does is it takes carbon dioxide, CO2, out of the atmosphere and pulls that into the plant. The plant feeds on it. It grows. It drops sugar deposits into the soil, which feeds soil life. It gets deeper roots. Those roots get further, allow water to permeate, and then it spits out oxygen for us to breathe, leaving that carbon behind. And that carbon creates more and more life and more vitality in that soil. So, again, that's carbon drawdown. That's creation of oxygen. And it's more armor on the soil. It allows for more water infiltration, right? Those tap roots going down into the ground allow water to come down. So now we're getting into these interesting drought conversations, right? You know, we live in a world now where everybody's constantly in a drought or they're flooding. In agriculture, you know, the way you survive through a period of drought is having water on the side. And the best way to have water on the side is to have it permeating into your soil and stored there so that, you know, the periods of abundance, you're getting effective use of rain and it actually absorbs into the ground instead of running off, causing a flood. And then in those periods of drought, you're tapping into that. Your water, your rain didn't run off. Your rain absorbed. Most land, at agriculture land in the U.S. Is no longer effectively capturing rain, which is why we're seeing more floods. And then the bigger toll and a greater cost during droughts. So again, leaving green plants growing year round, and then not, of course, you know, like that first principle, not tilling, emitting carbon up and promoting all these issues. The last two principles kind of relate. The fourth one is diversity. Different plants of different shapes and sizes are, you know, do different things during different seasons. Some actually fix nitrogen, veggies and clovers and things like turnips, which can be cash crops. You no longer need to spray chemical synthetic nitrogen as a fertilizer if you're planting things that are pulling nitrogen out of the atmosphere. Let's be honest, like, think upwards of 70% of the atmosphere is nitrogen. Why are we buying this stuff if we can plant something, protect our soil, honor these principles, and get, you know, hundreds of dollars per acre worth of nitrogen for free, while making our soil resource even better? And the last one is animal impact, right? We live in a continent that benefited from the original soil builders, which were the bison, right? This is the largest herd of megafauna since the last ice age. They used to roam from Mexico to Canada in numbers between 40 and 60 million, maybe more, doing incredible things. You know, helping honor these principles of regenerative agriculture through their hoof impact, pounding down dead and decaying, oxidizing organic matter and grasses. So they're at the surface level, giving that layer of thatch, holding in moisture and making it accessible for breakdown and decay. Biting grass along the way, unselectively grazing it, which causes it to, a chain reaction that feeds soil life, urinating, which gives it water during seasons of drought, defecating, which is giving it more biology and literally fertilizer as they move on and don't come back for months at a time, right? I mean, this is one of the, they call it a keystone species because it has a disproportionate impact even to its numbers on an ecosystem. And we no longer can do that, right? We don't have those bison roaming any longer. So this is where agriculture comes into play. You know, we've put out a lot of dams. There's a lot of fences. There's private property rights. There's public property rights. How do we recognize that these things in nature that we've been dependent on and had created fertility in our systems that we've been mining created a finite resource, and then emulate, or as best as we can, mimic those things in the way we manage our lands and practice agriculture. So managing cattle in a way that would be symbolic of how those bison might have moved across your own land, right? Letting them, doing planned holistic grazing, letting them rotate, not come back to the same area, being a little, you know, for months at a time, being a little more dense in those rotations, managing them in that way, right? Remember, like we talked about, replacing management in place of inputs in a farming context, right? Not spraying pesticides, right? Pesticides unselectively kill insects, right? They kill the pollinators that you need to pollinate your crops. In many cases, you have more incidences of undesirable pests after spraying than you do if you hadn't have sprayed at all. And you unselectively kill all positive insects as well, right? Every acre has something like a billion favorable insects that do important things that will make your land better and crop better. But if we spray, you know, we lose the benefit of that service. And so, you know, all of these sorts of things, you know, up to and including, we talked about, you know, the community and the impact on the farmer, right? Not handling toxic chemicals is pretty beneficial for an individual, but having stacked revenue streams where instead of tilling and having fallow fields, you're producing more food per acre. So you're able to feed more people and you're able to generate more revenue for doing it. Right. I mean, and at the end of the day, again, you're creating habitat for wildlife, you're creating habitat for insects, you're improving your soil base. Again, it's almost ridiculous how much of a win. I mean, just keep going down the line. Everybody's winning, with the exception of some really large industrial complexes selling chemicals or petroleum or some other stuff. Right. Who really want to make sure that we continue to be reliant on a system that's sort of taking a toll on the rest of us.
Man, it's a That's a very thorough, good explanation. I think I've wrapped my head around it, Colin.
Yeah, I have a question actually about it. I recently learned about cover crops a few months ago. I was driving through like Central Oregon and was wondering what all the red and white flowers covering the farm fields were. And so I looked it up and realized that it was crimson clover and white clover, and realized what they do for the soil and the nitrogen and why they have it. But I guess my question for the outside observer, somebody who doesn't know a lot about regenerative agriculture and is listening to the show here, is there a way to tell just driving through the countryside, like, oh, that's a regenerative agriculture farm? Or is there not really any way to tell? Like, which ones should I cheer on, and which ones should I curse under my breath as I'm driving by?
I think the answer is a little bit yes and no. The no part of the answer is it's hard to tell just by looking at anything at a specific moment in time what really is going on and what the story is there. Okay. And even a farm that could be, maybe they were conventional last year, and they are converting their practices and they're early on in their journey. You know, they're not going to have the Garden of Eden look that maybe some of the more, folks that have been doing this for 20 years and have just got it all figured out might, right? So I wouldn't, and frankly, there's nobody that I would want to curse, right? I mean, everybody's trying to do the best they can.
I said that in jest. There.
Yeah, I know. Right. I know, but I think everybody's trying to do, they're all part of a system and a community that is, in some cases, folks are telling, perpetuating the status quo and convinced of it. But, I think with more awareness and more and more empirical research, which we're seeing more and more of, it's going to become obvious what the solution is and what the direction to go is. So I just don't want to vilify anybody that's struggling, quite frankly. But and tragically, even, it's actually through a lot of that struggle that we're seeing more and more folks do regenerative agro or move into it. Right? They're maybe a fifth generation farmer who's like, I can't pay my bills. I'm in more debt every year and I got to keep buying. I got to up my chemical load, and I lost one more crop, and the insurance bill came in and didn't quite cover my needs. And I got two choices, sell my family's legacy or try something crazy. And usually that should be something crazy is regenerative agriculture. But, some of the things you might see if it was obvious on the land was you'd never see bare ground. You wouldn't drive down the highway and see miles and miles and miles and miles and miles of exposed soil. Because somebody that is wanting to transition and practice regenerative agriculture would recognize that might be one of the worst things for their land that they could do. And it'd be harmful to themselves, and it would be harmful to the ecosystem that and wildlife, which they desperately would want. So that'd be a quick red flag. And then another one would be, how many species of plants do you see growing? You mentioned cover cropping. That was probably as much intercropping as anything else, right? They were. I mean, you're looking at hundreds of dollars per acre is the cost to spray nitrogen. I don't know how many acres of that vetch and clover you saw, but think about how much money that person is saving by having that stuff there and drawing carbon down and getting more rainfall capture and all that kind of stuff, right? So that is a sign of somebody that's starting to do some of the principles, as would somebody that has a tall crop of corn and then maybe some cover or intercrops in between or whatever. So you'll probably see some interesting things on agriculture lands. You look at fence lines. That's always a telltale sign. Somebody doing regenerative, their soil will probably have several inches more height to it. You'd essentially be like walking down a step because of erosion. When you're leaving the ground armored and you're leaving plants on it with roots in it, your soil is not eroding away in the wind or in the rain. The EPA lists soil as the number one pollutant in the U.S. water supply. That's the rate at which we're moving soil. And soil is this tiny layer of skin that wraps the globe that all life, all terrestrial life depends on. You know what I mean? And it takes 500 plus years for nature to make an inch of topsoil. And we're just running that shit off. Sorry for the language, but
that's okay.
It is sacred. I mean, like, that should be a federal crime to allow soil to erode, because it compromises everything, right? So you might see that. And the other thing you see in these fence line photos is on one side of the fence looks a little sad, a little lackluster. On the other side of the fence, it looks lush and thriving, right? And that's usually the benefit of, you know, a few years of proper management where the system is much stronger, much more resilient through a variety of, you know, any type of stress you might throw. Again, drought, flood, heat, cold, you know, these systems aren't perfect, but they're more resilient. They're better at adapting and handling that sort of stuff. So I think the real question though, Colin, or maybe the real response is, what can a consumer do or what can a person do, right? And I think step one is starting to pay attention a little bit more and recognize that these issues do exist. And then step two is when you're buying stuff, whether it's food or anything else, when you're buying something, there's always a story behind it, you know, and you don't get to sit in like a presidential election where you don't like either candidate and you throw your hands up or whatever it may be, you just say, I'm out. You know, when you buy something, you're making a vote. You are actively mm-hmm. complicit and aligning with and supporting something that is consistent with your values or not. It's one or the other, right? You're supporting something against your own values, or you're supporting something in alignment with your values. You choose, right? And so maybe, you know, asking a few questions and getting to know the brands that you support. What do they stand for? What are they doing? You know, is this something that I want to give my dollars to perpetuating and continuing, or would I want to direct those someplace else that stands for something more important to me? And I'm not here to tell anybody what they should and shouldn't do and what they should believe in, right? I'm here to let folks know what's real and what's happening out there so that they can have that opportunity to make that conscious decision for them.
Yeah, no, I think you put that in a good perspective about like people's principles, and you're making a vote with what you're buying. You know, it's not just you're not like casting a ballot or anything like that, but I mean your dollars are going towards something. People record sales, they see what kind of influence they have over the market, and the more people who buy a certain product. And I think that's absolutely true. I think that's a really good point to bring up. Is that
I love that you use that analogy. It's like something I talk to my wife about all the time. She's like, oh, you know, what about this place? I'm like, no. Like, I don't care for that place. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to spend my money. I'm not going to vote for them. I'm not going to, you know, invest in that. Like, I'd rather, just as you said, I want to support the brands that yeah. I believe in, that have similar morals and values and align with the way I see my life going and, you know, the life of my kids and all the other things.
It's like buying wild caught salmon. I mean, if you're going to the store to buy meat and stuff, buying wild caught salmon versus the farm raised stuff. You know, it's,
you know, oh man,
right there.
We had a conversation the other day. So in moving to Colorado, like the availability of fresh seafood is not the same as it is in Key West. And we were strolling through the store the other day, and we had this exact conversation. And I was like, look, like, you know, my wife didn't always know that I only, if I do buy seafood, I generally always buy wild caught. And I'm very particular about what countries of origin I buy it from. U.S. is always first, but if not U.S., I'm very selective in what I buy. And it's just like, there's just some countries that I don't agree with their fishing industries and their fishing practices. So I won't support it. And I don't care if they're, you know, if I have to spend a difference of $25 or $30 in my purchase, it doesn't matter. Like, one, the flavor's better. Two, I'm not going to go and support something that I know is doing purposeful harm to the earth. Like, that's
well,
it.
And I think yeah, an interesting
example. On the same way, I was raised the same way.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Robbie.
No, totally. I think that's awesome. Those are great examples. And I think, you know, I would expand on that and say, you know, what's interesting to me is that folks will do that. And then when they're buying their dog food, say, oh, well, my dog doesn't need nice stuff too. And it's like, well, it's not just about what you're giving your dog. It's, again, are you just canceling out your own consumption by continuing to support a system that, you know, again, doesn't stand for your values, right? So it's more to it, right? And it's not, and then even beyond that, right? It's, you know, don't, there's a family farmer nearby that needs your support, that's getting squeezed off their land. So whether you're buying it for your pet food company that you're supporting, or the food company that you're supporting for yourself, or the clothing company that you buy, or the seafood that you buy, right? And, you know, you always have an opportunity to stand for something. And not everybody has the ability to do that all the time, and not everywhere you go. But when you have that chance, and when you can afford it, and when it's, you know, you have access to something, you know, I know what I do with those opportunities, and I would encourage folks to just be a little bit more conscious and a little bit more present about, you know, making sure that they're proud of what they're doing and that they're standing up for the things that they believe in at every opportunity.
I think that allows us to tie it back in towards hunting and angling.
great transition there.
as hunters and anglers, you know, we want to be good stewards of the land, conservation, sustainability. Like all these practices are aligning. You know, you do the same thing in the outdoor industry when you're buying equipment. Like, you want something that's dependable, but you also want to get from a company that, you know, is supporting what you're doing and, you know, involved in conservation and a lot of the same things. And it all follows full circle, and I think it helps to stay as a well-rounded individual in that instance.
Yeah, I think you know, it's what's interesting for me, and you know, bringing it back to hunting and fishing is, you know, there's no doubt that the best way to procure your food is to get out in some wild land and go spend hours, if not days, really interacting with the environment and forming that sort of bond and relationship with not just nature, but even your game and the animal you eventually kill, and you know, that it becomes nourishment to feed you, your family, and your friends and your community, right? I mean, you can't, for somebody that's never experienced that, it's hard to convey until they have their first moment, but there's nothing more human than that, right? Yeah, and the same could be said for foraging and other parts of your food, right? And that is not available to everybody all the time. And I would say the next best way to get your food is to find the farmer or rancher down the road. You can go, you know, to kind of to Colin's question, you can go validate what they're doing. You know, are they honoring those principles of regenerative agriculture? What do they stand for? What is their why? You know, do they care about the end consumer? Do they care about their land? Do they care about conservation? Did they bring bees in and put pollinators in because they know it's needed? You know, they have owls. You have habitat. You know, what are they doing, right? You know, and you know, vetting them out that they're you know, somebody that's conscious about their practices, and they're managing and stewarding the land and adding value not just to the food but to the land base and buying it from your neighbor. That's also not available to everybody, right? And I think what we're trying to do with Force of Nature is be the next best thing to getting it from the wild or getting it from truly your neighbor, and being available at a national scale with a brand that is familiar, that you can trust, that offers a variety of proteins, and we sell it in retail as well as online direct to consumer, you know, and we do a lot of stuff like this podcast, and we put out a lot of content on our blogs, on our webpage, and we're active on Instagram and social media, trying to tell the story of food and trying to, you know, bring people into a much bigger, it's a very broad and deep conversation, right? But there's some little tie-in for everybody, to you know, to get their attention and to engage them in it. And, you know, we want to create that awareness and then make sure that folks have access. So should they agree with us, they have that opportunity to, you know, cast a better vote with their next purchase. And so I'm right there with you. I mean, that's how my values came to be. It was through hunting, through fishing, through getting on the land and seeing just how special that is, and recognizing, you know, that when you kill an animal and you take a life, I mean, you guys feel it. It's bittersweet. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, it's the epic culmination of everything that you hoped and dreamed of, with a little bit of sorrow and a little bit of sadness that it's over and that there's a sacrifice and that something died for you. But man, that makes you appreciate it that much more. And kind of like Colin talking about his nutria, you know what I mean? When you take something's life, you respect the hell out of it. You don't let any of it go to waste, right? And I think we live in a country where 40% of food goes in the garbage can. And what greater tragedy? I mean, could you imagine you go out and you go on an epic elk hunt and then just the first thing you do is chunk 40% of it in the garbage? Like, never. Not a million years. Yeah. You know what I mean? And so just having that appreciation and respect for food is, I think really, really important. And we're trying to foster that connection, right? Connect people to the, to their food, to the animals, to the farmers, to the land, and let us be a little bit more human and a little bit less veiled, and shielded from the truth.
I think that's such a, it's such an important thing too, is too, and being open and welcome about the conversation. And, you know, the use of social media these days is it's much easier to do that. To, you know, we look at back 20, 30 years ago, like you and I having this conversation, how possible would that have been? I would have had to travel down there. You would have had to travel up here. Like we would have had to work it out. But, you know, through the use of technology and things like Instagram and Facebook, we're able to open up the eyes of the public and of individuals who want to change and want to find different habits in eating, who want to hunt and fish and learn and, you know, participate in regenerative agriculture, to know their local farmer. And I think those moments are very, very special. And, you know, I say thanks to you for, you know, for fostering that type of ideal and for this conversation.
Well, I definitely appreciate that. It's you know, taking on conventional food and big agriculture and big chemical is no small fight. But, you know, I truly genuinely believe that this is what consumers want, you know, and I think mm-hmm. I think the truth is consumers are in control. You know, nobody's going to produce anything that a consumer doesn't want or doesn't buy. And I think the more access to more information, the better they understand the story and the power that they wield, the more we'll see what's available change and the consequences and the externalities of the food system be improved because consumers start to you know, choose a little bit differently. That doesn't happen without folks like you letting us tell the story. So I appreciate you guys as well.
Absolutely. So I want to shift a little bit to well, I've got a few minutes here left to chat to chat a little bit about Rome Ranch and some of your bison there. I'm a huge fan of bison. You touched on it earlier, but bison meat is probably one of my favorites. It's up there with the majority of wild game. But I know you do have some recipes on your website too, which I'll just mention real quick. We don't have to talk in depth about them because I want to kind of hear more about Rome Ranch. But bison tenderloin with some holiday cranberry glaze, bison Salisbury steaks and mushroom gravy. Like, those all sound great. Do you find that most, for those that don't know, do you find it comparable to beef when you look at it, the way it falls as far as like looking at domestically raised beef and wild game? Like, where does it fall in the spectrum?
Yeah, such an interesting question. I don't even think beef compares to beef. You know, I think we got this weird, it's one more of those weird paradigms where we have this super homogenized look at everything, right? Think about all the different breeds of cattle and all the different environments. You know, we were starting before the call talking about bear and, you know, one that we, not just bear, but bear that's been eating blueberries. You know, we've all heard the urban legend, right? So like, I want to try that, you know, and I think that there's so much uniqueness to a geography and a diet and a seasonality of food. But yeah, I mean, I think the bison, kind of like the classic red meat, like a beef, sure. You know, I think you see a lot more intermuscular fat in today's farm beefs. They've been bred that way, right? I mean, if you think about what beef is, it's not what cows are. They're not a real native animal. They've been bred to grow really fast on really cheap food, produce intermuscular fat, and be lazy and sedentary, so they get bigger, faster, and more tender. And I think that, you know, I like beef. I'm not knocking beef, right? But when you compare what a bison is in its current form today, it's a wild animal. It's the second fastest land mammal in North America. It's cunning and beautiful, and it's definitely not sedentary. And they eat a diverse diet, but yeah, I think they are, you know, have that richness and earthiness of beef. Maybe depending on the time of year, you get them with some of those sweet notes as well. But I might compare it more to like the midpoint between an elk and a modern like grass fed cow.
Okay. Yeah, I see that as a, yeah, that's Pretty solid comparison.
Yeah, and I love elk.
It's phenomenal. I'm so excited. September.
You should do a taste test. You should grab. We sell elk. We sell venison, wild boar, pork, bison, beef.
Oh yeah.
But I'll tell you what. Like our wild boar, I think is better than any pork. You know, and I think I'd put that elk and that bison up against any beef. It's just good. It's really good.
Robbie, do you deliver?
Yep.
Do you ship? Not deliver. I'm not expecting you to drive it for you. But, like, do you ship?
I will personally come drive it to your home, Colin. No, if you go to our website at forceofnature.com and our shop page and you place an order, yeah, we will deliver it to your door.
Awesome.
Yeah,
check
that's
that
pretty
out
cool.
After this.
I think a taste test is definitely in order. It'd be a good narrative piece for sure.
I think one of the things I was getting at, though, is that, you know, that wild boar versus the pork is really one of the things, right? If you think wild feral pig is just domesticated pig gone wild. You know, I think, as Jesse mm-hmm. probably said on your show, it was on the wrong side of the fence,
yep.
right? He loves to say that. it tastes markedly different, right? Because it's been allowed to run. It's healthy. It's expressing its mm-hmm. natural behaviors. It's eating a diverse diet. It's going to be leaner, but you get that. But the meat is what tastes good. I mean, fat is most popular, but you get so much more depth of character and flavor in the meat, which is why we all love elk so much, right? Fat can be critically important, but it can also just be a shortcut to make up for crappy taste in meat.
100%. So, but I mean, biologically, the way it works.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah. Right. So yeah, you know, like those more wild, you know, animals like that bison, it's just, I love that flavor profile a lot.
The complexity are there. And I appreciate too, and you mentioned it when you were talking about the shifts in the season and the changes. You know, you're looking at an animal that's not eating a standard diet, you know, a controlled diet. It's more variable, as you mentioned. So therefore, throughout the year, as they're eating different things, as plants mature and die off and the seasons change, you're getting different flavors from whatever they're eating. And I think, for me personally, that is what draws me most to wild game, is the fact that it's a direct representation of the environment that it lives in.
Isn't that amazing, though? I mean, isn't that, it's something that we always appreciate, right? If it was wine, mm-hmm. we'd be heralding those differences and noting the unique characteristics of it, right? If it was, hell, if it was scotch, we'd be celebrating how much it tastes like a fresh rain on asphalt or pencil lead or what, you know, they come up with these outrageous things to describe this stuff that doesn't even sound appetizing, and yet it becomes celebrated. But, you know, meat, if it doesn't taste exactly like some homogenized specific thing, then it's gamey or something else. It's like, no, there's so much more to it. I think red wine has something like 375 different, you know, flavor notes in it, and red meat has, like, you know, the next closest thing. There's really nothing else that compares in our culinary world to red meat and wine in terms of the amount of different flavors that you can generate out of it, right? And I wish we had a greater appreciation for meat the same way that we do with some of those other things.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, I think a side-by-side taste test would go really well with that kind of concept, because, I mean, people go to wineries and get a flight, or I guess they call it a tasting if you're classy, or they'll go to breweries and get a flight, or they'll go to a distillery and get like a flight of whiskey, like we were talking about scotch, and then you can get the pencil lead one, then you can get like the seawater one, and you can taste the differences between them. I think that's a really cool idea to do that with red meat. And I mean, I don't know if you can do it down there. If someday Justin opens up a brick and mortar restaurant, maybe he can do that too, but have like a side-by-side tasting, like the sampler platter, where you can see, you know, how the flavor changes across, you know, elk to deer to bison, or even elk from, you know, Western Oregon on the western side of the Cascades versus Rocky Mountain elk in the east, you know, just different flavor profiles like that. I think that'd be a really cool idea.
I totally agree.
Yeah. That's awesome. It's a good idea. And now it's stuck in my head. It's going to have to happen.
I'm keeping ducks. Don't worry, Justin.
Well, unfortunately, I think we've reached the end of the time here. Colin, do you have any last questions for Robbie?
No, I don't think so. I think he answered every question that I had, he answered. It was really informative. I don't know a lot about regenerative agriculture to begin with. You know, I've heard the term before. I had like a general concept, but you know, listening to Robbie talk about it and sit down and talk about it, like its benefits and how it can help just the general environment with the world that we're in today, I think that's really cool. I'm really glad that you got to come on and talk about it on the show.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me. Like I said, can't thank you enough for letting me share my thoughts and help tell the story of food. And for you guys, I want to learn more. Any listeners, you know, forceofnature.com is our website, and mm-hmm. at @forceofnaturemeats is our Instagram handle. And we pretty much do nothing but put information out on this sort of stuff, right? And so I'd encourage anybody to go check us out and try to educate yourselves. I'm not going to ask you to buy anything. I'm just going to say, just do like we spoke about a minute ago, right? Try to be a little more conscious, a little more present, and get a better sense of what system you're supporting. And if you're out hunting an elk and you can get that first choice for the best way to harvest your meat, great. And if you have an amazing regenerative rancher right next door to you, support them absolutely. And if not, you'll consider if what we're doing inspires you and aligns with the sort of system you want to be a part of, then we'd love to have you as a customer. So thanks, you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that comes to mind is I graduated high school years and years ago, but a good family friend told me, he said, you know, go off to college, learn and listen and take in everything you can, because education is the one thing that nobody can take away from you. And it's always resonated with me. So I definitely, with that, encourage everyone listening to go check out the Instagram and website and get some knowledge and, you know, make a decision. We're not telling you what you're doing right or what you're doing is right or what you're doing is wrong. It's the opportunity to make your own decision. So I think that's a key takeaway in my mind. But thanks again, Robbie, for coming on. It was really awesome having you. I would like to thank everyone out there for listening. As always, the show notes will be online. You'll get links to all these great things, recipes I mentioned, links to Force of Nature, all those great things. And once you're done checking out Force of Nature, head over, make sure you're following us on the Harvest of Nature page. And then whatever podcast platform you're listening to, punch that 5-star button. Tell us what we're doing right, or you can tell us what we're doing wrong. We just love the feedback. So anyway, thanks everybody. Have a good night.